in the first case.
May it please the court, Mr. Harold Bell will present argument for the defendant.
May it please the court, I am Harold Felt, and as has been announced, I am representing the petitioner, Mr. H.L. Brown. This is a lawsuit involving a dispute between a landlord and a tenant. The tenant in this case is the respondent, the Republic Bank First National of Midland. The tenant in the case is my client, Mr. Brown. Now, this situation and the facts out of which this dispute arose occurred at a time when the community, Midland, in which this matter developed, was flourishing. The First National Bank of Midland was the entity that was involved, and it was a predecessor to the Republic Bank. The First National Bank of Midland, the evidence and the record will reflect, badly wanted to purchase a piece of property that was owned by a trust of Mr. Brown's children, or for Mr. Brown's children. Mr. Brown is an independent oil operator, and he leased that property from his children. The bank wanted to buy it. The bank did buy that piece of property. In connection with the bank's acquisition of all of the rights to that property, the bank entered into what was called a termination agreement with Mr. Brown to buy and obtain his leasehold rights in his children's property. That termination agreement gave Mr. Brown certain rights. It gave him a right to obtain interim office space after he moved out of his building. It gave him $100,000 for moving and relocation of cost. It gave him parking spaces at another location. It gave him a right to terminate his leasehold interest in the temporary space to which he was going to move with 30 days written notice to the First National Bank. Mr. Brown moved. That's just a summary of some of the rights and duties in that so-called termination agreement. Mr. Brown moved. He stayed in the temporary space for more than 2 years. And then he gave 30 days written notice and moved out. After the termination agreement was entered into, Mr. Brown, as would be expected, had to enter into a sublease, giving him a right to be in the temporary space. He signed that sublease, subleasing property in another building for this temporary space from the First National Bank. That sublease and the lease agreement which he subleased did not have a termination provision. My argument has been in the trial court and the Court of Appeals that you should read the termination agreement and the sublease together, and that he retained the 30-day termination right. I've lost on that. I lost in the trial court. I lost in the Court of Appeal. On the other hand, I have argued that when Mr. Brown terminated his lease, which I submit he had a right to do, thought he had a right to do, now it's been established he did not, that it is absolutely clear, and the record will reflect the letters that Mr. Brown gave the bank saying, I'm moving, no question about it. He did move. It is no doubt in the record that the bank was fully aware that he moved pursuant to his effort to terminate. He was gone. The record reflects that the only thing in his former office space was one telephone, which he says he didn't own the telephone company owned. He was gone. Now, the question that is the focal point, the centerpiece before this court is, can that bank, or the successor to the First National Bank, the Republic Bank, sit idly by and say, we will make no effort whatsoever in the whole world to re-lease that building and thereby mitigate the damages. We are going to stand by for the remainder of the lease, month to month, day to day, year to year, and do nothing.
Mr. Felton, before you go any further, do I understand you're conceding on the argument that he did not have the right to terminate?
Sir, Judge, I have never given up on that. It's just that the points of error that were accepted by the court were not on my argument that you should read the two leases together.
Well, I would certainly like for you to save some time to go into that, if you would, before you finish your argument.
Yes, sir, I will.
Hey, counsel, just because we don't grant on those points don't mean they're not up here.
All right.
They are up here, and just being we have a little more interest in the other points. So the whole case is here.
Well, I decided that, by golly, I'd rear back and get after the mitigation point because it looked to me like there was good interest in it. But
just give us a whole load of hay.
All right, sir. The argument, and I'll keep going on the mitigation, and I will save some time with respect to the other argument. The argument with respect to the mitigation point is that the law of contracts, without any question whatsoever, is that when a contract is breached, or when a tort is committed as well, that there is a duty to mitigate the damages, to minimize the damages. No question about that. Look at the Texas jurisprudence, the CJS, and look at the cases, and that's clear. The question is that the law in Texas may well be, and I admit to this court, probably there is more authority as it exists today, that when you have a leasehold contract for real estate, that the landlord has no duty to mitigate the damages. There is a case cited in my brief that is the Racky, R-A-C-K-E, I believe, versus Anheuser-Busch case, in which, really, I suggest to the court, if you read the opinion, as an aside, it was observed that, of course, where there is a breach of a lease such as this, such as a commercial lease, that the landlord does not have to go out and re-lease. And the cases took off recognizing that.
What's the reason for the distinction, or the reasons that are given?
The reason that is given for that, I believe that this court addressed in the David Dow case, that when you have, and by the way, so we're not going to recognize it anymore, but basically, that when you have a lease of real estate for a term of years, that you apply pure real estate law, and that you do not apply the law of contracts where you have a duty to mitigate. And the theory is, going back to old feudal times and the old agrarian society, that when you gave the serfs a lease on land, that they needed to get a real conveyance of property that nobody could take away, and real estate law absolutely unequivocally controlled. And I submit that we have gotten away from that, and I have cited cases which I think do an exceptional job of setting forth the reasons for getting away from that in many, many other jurisdictions. And I believe that one of the good cases that lays all that out analyzes why we should apply contract law as well as real estate law to a commercial leasehold. The case of Dushoff versus Phoenix Company out of Arizona, which is in my brief. And I think the very, very best analysis of why we should get away from that theory is the case of Wright versus Ballman, which comes out of Oregon. The state of Colorado, I submit to, and it's also in my brief, the state of Colorado, I submit to the court in the case of Shinneker versus Gordon, which is a 1987 case out of the Supreme Court of Colorado, addresses the same situation that you may find yourself in, and that is that there was a substantial body of law recognizing the old real estate versus contract theory, and the Supreme Court of Colorado said, we're just not going to go that way. Now the question is, how should you treat a lease? How should you treat a commercial leasehold interest? The respondent in the case says, Mr. Felt comes before you and he says to you that this does not involve real estate, that this is a leasehold, a commercial leasehold should be treated purely by the dictates, the mandates of contract law. I don't say that. I understand that the conveyance of a leasehold has real estate considerations. You can assess ad valorem taxes against it. You file a lease at the clerk's office. Forcible entry and detainer does apply. But I think you have to look at each lease and each fact situation, and most of the time in a commercial lease, as well as a conveyance of a real estate interest, in our modern society and in the Wright versus Ballman case, I can't say it better. There is contractual obligation after contractual obligation in a commercial lease. What kind of maintenance is going to be provided? Who's going to provide what sort of repairs? What sort of elevator service are you going to have? Just page after page after page of pure contractual provisions that have as much or in most instances more to do with the heart of the contract than just the conveyance of the land. So as you recognized, I submit, in Davidow, that where appropriate contract law should apply, and you should not just say we hereby exclude all contract law to a commercial lease because it in many ways does involve real estate. Now, if it is good law, to me it narrows down to just this kind of simple question. If it is good law that you should have a duty to mitigate damage, then I submit to the court, what in the world, what one single reason in the whole wide world is it to say when there is a landlord-tenant situation and the tenant has breached the lease agreement, if he did, that that landlord, like every other field of the law, does not have a duty to go out and mitigate the damages? What? Why wouldn't he have that duty? What's wrong with it if it's right across all of our law of contracts and torts? Mr. Brown, one of the arguments that is placed before this honorable court by the respondent is that, well, think of what it would do to mortgage transactions if this court changed the law on mitigation. You take a bundle of leases when you build a building, and you go over to the bank and you borrow money on those leases. My goodness, they say it would upset that sort of everyday business. if you allowed mitigation of damages. How could that happen? What difference would it make to that sort of commercial transaction? If they carried Mr. Brown's lease over to borrow money and said, we're doing that on Mr. Brown's lease, and Mr. Brown breached it, wrongfully assumed, he is still on that lease. He still owes that money. That is just as good a lease for that bank that loaned money for the purpose of building the building as it ever was. All I'm saying, in addition to Mr. Brown being on the lease and being responsive in damages as he would be, that Mr. Brown's damages under our common law jurisprudence should be lowered by the amount that the landlord could reasonably have mitigated. And the cases in the other jurisdictions, and I think it was recognized in Davidow, what greater economic waste could you lay on society than have that empty space there and the landlord have a right to just say, I'm going to let it sit. I'm not even going to try to lease it.
What obligation do you contend that the breaching tenant has to mitigate damage?
The breaching tenant, I say that mitigation of damages is absolutely and purely something that is placed under our law on the defendant, on the non-breaching party. What my client, if he breached it, has got a duty to do is not mitigate it. He has a duty to pay every red cent of damages, 100%.
Well, you're asking us to change the law now, Mr. Fell. Say, under the law, the landlord is the only one has any duty to mitigate. You're asking us to change the law to reach that point. And I'm just asking you as a philosophical question, or however you want to put it, you can't conceive of a lot of situations where a landlord maybe is not present. He leases a building and takes off. Maybe he's absentee owner. He doesn't live in the state where the building is. He enters into a contract. Okay, I've got my business in order. I'm going back home. I've got a good, solid tenant with a top credit rating in that building. He leaves and the tenant takes off. And you say the man got to come back into Texas or wherever and whatever a jury says a landlord ought to do with no duty on that tenant to find another tenant when he moves out. Now, if you're going to go on an equitable basis, which is I understand what you're arguing, where do we strike the balance on equity?
All right. Let me answer that in several points. First of all, I think, probably asking you to change the law with respect to mitigation as it goes to a commercial tenant. I could stand here and pull out a couple of cases and argue that there was law out there for me, but I'll concede that to you. But I am not standing here asking you, and just as candidly as I know how, I think it would be a great mistake for the court to change the law of mitigation of damages. What I am saying is, I don't want you to change the law of mitigation as damages, as your philosophical question suggests, and put on the breaching party a duty to mitigate in this one simple type of case. I want you just to apply the law of mitigation of damages as it applies in every other kind of case known in the jurisprudence. And I argue that it would be inappropriate to mess with the mitigation law and in one instance put it on the breaching party. I argue that that is contrary to the law. And that philosophically to say that the tenant, because this is a special situation, ought to have a duty to mitigate known no other place in the law, I don't feel that is appropriate. I think then you just start creating exceptions to the mitigation. And I submit to you that is not appropriate. The next part of your question. Don't forget that I stand here and argue that mitigation, there's two parts to it. The number one part to the mitigation is that the guts of it is that a non-breaching party has a duty to mitigate, has a duty to go out and try to find some way to lessen the damages once he knows of the breach and before they occur. But this is the key. He only has a duty to act reasonably in mitigation. And reasonable is very important. If under the facts in any particular case, he cannot reasonably mitigate whatever we may hypothetically come up with, he can't reasonably go out and release because he is in a bad position. But for any reason that it is a fact question, nothing wrong with fact questions, as to whether or not in this particular situation it is reasonable. That is the way you solve, I think, what you asked me about. Well, maybe the tenant, the landlord can't do it. Maybe he's got such problems that it's not appropriate. In the law, that's cast in terms of reasonableness. Now, that brings me to a point. In this case, it is raised before this court. Once the court, as I observed earlier, demonstrated interest in the mitigation, I submit that if you follow the appellate record in this case, that the court will see that now that respondent is arguing that they undertook reasonable effort. My argument in that part, my mitigation argument, is twofold. Number one, the landlord ought to, by golly, have a duty to mitigate. Number two, that the landlord was not reasonable, and there is no evidence that he was reasonable, and there is no doubt in the world that he was not reasonable in my case. And the reason I say that is that in the brief in the Court of Appeals, first, summarizing the record in this case, the respondent said that finally, and as stated by Mr. Bound, Republic Bank did not attempt to relet the space in the Paragon building, which was abandoned by Mr. Brown. The record is quoted in the briefs where I ask, you're telling this court that you take the position that despite the fact that he wrote you a letter saying, I hereby terminate my lease, that the reason you didn't do it is because you had to save it for Mr. Brown? Answer, it was under lease. I had no right to sublet it or even make an attempt to sublet it. And that's the reason you did not make one single effort to lease his space. Answer, yes, sir. Now, they raised the question that the record reflects that Mr. Stevenson, who was the building manager responsible for leasing, had tried to lease some other space in the Paragon unsuccessfully. The lawyer for the respondent cross-examined my witness, who testified that it could be leased, about my witness having trouble leasing his law office some more space. That the bank ran an ad unsuccessfully to lease some space some other place in town. But the way it cut, absolutely, I say, is that they did not make one effort. Therefore, I say that they did not act reasonably to try because they didn't do anything. And secondly, that they should have done something to try to mitigate. That is what my argument is.
Does the record indicate that what the relationship of the timing of this lease and the timing of the slump in Midland when First Bank went under and the Republic Bank came in, the FDIC came in, what is the time frame of all that happening, if it's in the record?
Let me say this, it's not. I mean, we didn't try the slump, so to speak, but I think the court can glean exactly when the slump in Midland was, and the way I submit that the record reflects that we got into this thing is that the FDIC bought this sublease The FDIC sold it to the Republic Bank.
Was Mr. Brown still in when they bought it?
No, sir. And the Republic Bank is the respondent in this case. So the bank had gone under. And the Republic Bank is the one that came after Mr. Brown. I've argued Tom Blue in the face that, you know, if we'd had the old First Nationalists, we wouldn't be here. But we're down the road. The FDIC came in, the Republic came in, and then the Republic came after Mr. Brown, said he didn't have that 30-day notice to terminate, that we argued that we had negotiated with the old First National. So in that sense, the slump is there. But let me go ahead and argue this to you. I pleaded and I claimed not that the lease was worth what it was worth when Mr. Brown bought it. I put an expert witness on it. That expert witness testified that the lease did not have the same value as when Mr. Brown leased it, but that it could have been leased, that it was not worth it. And he told how much it could have been leased for per square foot. And if you subtract what he said it could have been leased for versus what the lease Mr. Brown was on, if he was on it, you come up with a difference of $157,000 plus. Then if Mr. Brown loses, he owes $83,000 and not $240,000 in round numbers. And that is the only testimony about the value. It stands, I argue to the court, it just stands. And I don't say that that lease was worth what it was worth. And in that way, it's recognized that there was a slump. I just say this to this court. And we know we've got lease problems around the state. I mean, we take notice of that. And when someone, as in this case, has breached the lease agreement, all I say is, let's back off and think 1 minute. Why is it right? Why is it good? And I was going to stand here like you always do as I plotted to make my speech this morning and read, because I can't state in as learned and erudite a fashion as was stated in the Arizona case that I cited to you and in the Oregon case I cited to you why it is wrong to just rear back and say, when you find yourself in this situation, don't do anything. Don't do as Mr. Stevenson said, and I am not going to make one single effort. I'm just going to let that lease sit there and those damages accrue. And I'm not saying he's got to go out and make a lease. I'm just saying he's got to make reasonable efforts to try, just like any other case in our jurisprudence. And that sounds reasonable to me.
Counselor, your time is about to expire. Were you going to touch on your argument that you have a right to terminate?
Yes, sir. What happened is that we entered into this termination agreement. This termination agreement is in the record before this court. That termination agreement, I submit, should be read with the sublease. And very candidly, in the cases that we rely on are cited, but very candidly, I argued that it was a clear, plain, and unambiguous agreement when you read the two agreements together, and that you should read the two agreements together. The trial court agreed with me in the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law. The Court of Appeals sustained the trial court. But what they said was that when you read my termination agreement, which I say, once I got over that hump and it was agreed by the trial court and the Court of Appeals that you should read them together, that the clear, plain, and unambiguous meaning of the agreement is that the 30-day termination right remained in place and should be read with the sublease, and that there is no other way to clearly, plainly, and unambiguously read that provision.
How do you respond to the Court of Appeals when they write, reading and construing contracts together does not justify bodily taking one paragraph from one contract and transplanting it to another? Exactly what you're asking them to do.
No, Judge, I think what I'm saying is different. I'm not saying that you have to just bodily take it and read it by itself. I'm saying you have to read all of the sublease. I'm saying you have to read all of the termination agreement. I'm saying that when you put the two together, you have to read them from their four corners and construe what they mean together with all of the rights and duties of the parties, period. It, as they say, the contract which we now say are the two agreements together means what it says and says what it means. It's clear, plain, and unambiguous. And, sir, I appreciate it.
We will now hear argument from Ms. Palmer.
Please, this honorable court. My name is Jerry Procro. I represent, in this case, Republic Bank First National of Midland, as I've been introduced. In today's argument, I would like to proceed, and I tell the court this so that you have some idea of my roadmap. If I disagree with what you want to hear, I'd ask the court to tell me. But initially, I would like to cover some facts that I think are important in this particular case, which perhaps distinguish it from the presentation that Mr. Felt has made, and perhaps distinguish it from some of those other cases which have been urged as authority for changing a law that's been longstanding in the state of Texas. Then I would like to analyze, if the court would allow, those particular cases out of Oregon and Colorado and discuss with you the underlying concepts which will cause the courts, in my opinion, to reach their conclusion. And finally, I would like to argue with you, if you have decided, or if this court concludes that this is to be decided purely on contract principles, that in this particular case, the contract principles will result in the court finding that the Court of Appeals was absolutely correct in its analysis and would support affirming both the trial court and the Court of Appeals. Returning first to the facts in this particular case that I think are very significant. First, as Mr. Feld has said, this is a lease case. But Mr. Brown was a sublessee. First National of Midland had leased Paragon space. It did not own the building. It was owned by a company called Paragon Partners. So the First National Bank of Midland had a lease, a base lease. It entered into that base lease, which provided many, many covenants by contract and contained many provisions. After accepting that lease and entering into possession of the premises, the negotiations with Mr. Brown began. The base lease was in 1981. In March of 1982, as Mr. Felt said, the Brown Trust entered into an arrangement whereby it sold a building in Midland to the First National Bank, and Mr. Brown agreed, because he was a tenant in his children's trust building, he agreed to get out of that building, and he had an agreement with regard to termination. That's in March of 82. That is the situation until May of 1982. From March to May, the record, I believe, reflects that negotiations continued between Mr. Brown, who had agreed to vacate his premises, and the First National Bank of Midland, who were trying at that point to obtain a consent to sublease from the Paragon Partners and trying to obtain his vacating the original premises. During this interim negotiation, that is from March to May, two things happened. Mr. Brown negotiated a new term of the lease. Originally, he had been given 24 months occupancy of the Paragon space. That 24 months was to be initially a period of free rent, then a period of 6 months where he would pay the actual rent which First National Bank had paid to the Paragon Partners. He expanded that. He expanded it, I submit, to the full term of the lease. Under the base lease in 1981, First National Bank had a 5-year term, which carried it through February of 1987. Mr. Brown negotiated and received the agreement of the First National Bank to go from a 24-month right of occupancy of the Paragon space to a full 5-year term, or what was left of the 5-year term. He further negotiated for an extension beyond that 5-year term if the First National Bank of Midland exercised its option under the base lease for an additional 5 years. Mr. Brown wanted that too. So by his contract, he obtained the right to potentially carry this lease out for a term of 10 years if the option to renew was exercised. That option was never exercised, and the primary term of 5 years was the term that we're discussing. The May 30th, 1982 sublease agreement, which is the contract we believe we are before the court under.
And that's the renegotiated lease?
That is the sublease done in May of 1982, which is the renegotiation, the result of the renegotiation. And let me say that I think the consideration that was given to the First National Bank for the extended term, I believe it's the consideration that there would be no option to terminate, because the May 1982 agreement has no option to terminate in it. And that is the sole additional consideration I think the court will find if you compare the two agreements. So in exchange for the extended term, the First National Bank obtained the right to have that without a termination provision.
Can you quote us any case authority that say you can imply that consideration when you're paying his rent, which is certainly the main consideration for any lease?
It's additional term of which he's going to pay rent. That is, he is agreeing to pay the rent beyond the first 24 months. No, sir, I don't have the case that I can cite to you. The situation, though, that I would point to the court is that May 30th, 1982, the second agreement, does not incorporate by reference the agreement to terminate Mr. Brown's original lease in the children's building. It does incorporate the original 1981 base lease. Let me cover a couple more fact questions quickly. One is that Mr. Brown, prior to entering into his May 30th, 1982, had counsel of his own selection, and the court found that he had counsel of his own selection. The court also found he had equal negotiation power or bargaining position, and the finding of fact of the trial court, we believe, are significant in the analysis we'll be getting to. The sublease, which is the May 30th, 1982 agreement, repeatedly contains language whereby Mr. Brown assumed all rights and obligations and liabilities of the First National Bank under the base lease. Now that's where I think the court will have to focus in its analysis of the particular facts in this case. What contract provision or what lease provision are we really discussing and considering in this particular case? I submit it is not a collateral provision which is a continuing obligation such as in Davidow. The court used a contract analysis in Davidow, I believe, because the court was saying when you look at the right to maintain the premises, to keep the heat, to keep the air conditioning, to keep the premises up, that you have an ongoing duty of the landlord. And it's more contractual in nature than it is real property in nature. But in this particular case, we're dealing with the covenant to pay rent and the covenant to give to the tenant the peaceful use and enjoyment of the premises for the term of the lease. Now, if you go to the two cases that Mr. Feld has argued and in his brief presents most forcefully, that is the Colorado case and the case from Oregon, I think you'll see some parallels that are very important in the analysis in this particular case. The Schenecker or Schenecker case out of Colorado, Schenecker versus Gordon, let me pronounce it, or call it Gordon because I can pronounce that one, is an important case, but it's not a change from the law in Texas, I submit. The Colorado Supreme Court went through a detailed analysis and noted that initially, when the first leases were considered by courts in English common law, pure contract principles were applied. Mr. Felt, in his oral argument, talked about it being a feudal concept. But I submit to the court that we started out initially under lease law talking pure contract theories. But that was not sufficient or satisfactory. That did not give to the tenant protections and rights that the law soon reasoned the tenant should have. And so the courts from the 15th, 17th, 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries added to the property, to the contract concepts, the real property concepts, and came to the analysis that you have in a lease, a commercial lease or a residential lease, two grants. One is the grant of a term of an estate and land for a term based on the consideration to pay rent. That was used by the courts to say you have an interest in the real property. It's from that right and from that covenant and contractual arrangement that the tenant receives the protection that Mr. Phelps already talked about. I'll mention a couple more. The protection of a homestead, a business homestead, or the protection to have specific performance, or the protection to go into a district court and ask for restraining orders or injunctive relief based upon the proposition that the lease is unique and it has an interest in land which justifies a specific remedy, that is injunctive relief or specific performance. And that remedy is an important attribute which the courts have given both to landlords and to tenants. I submit that if the court were to accept Mr. Fell's argument in its entirety, the court will reverse that century-old concept that you have this conveyance of an estate in real property for a term based upon the consideration of paying a rent. The court in Colorado analyzed that and said, we are going to recognize that there is a privity of estate arising out of a lease, but there's also privity of contract. And I'm going to use those terms because that's the way the Colorado Supreme Court analyzed it, and I think it is helpful. They looked at the facts before them, and they saw a situation where you had a subtenant, like in our case, leasing from a base lessee. In the Colorado case, you had a car wash. It was rented out to the first fellow for $600 a month. But the first fellow turned around and subleased it to another fellow, Mr. Gordon. He leased it for $1,900 a month. Mr. Gordon went into possession of the property, stayed in the property, found it was not economical, and moved out. Now, the sublessor, Mr. Schenninger, decided after a period of time that he would negotiate to cancel the base lease. He did not exercise the option of staying, paying $600 a month to his landlord and demanding $1,900 a month from the subtenant. He found that was uneconomical. The Colorado Supreme Court says that's economical. Reality is that's not going to continue to happen because the first tenant, the fellow that's paying $600 a month, is totally at risk. Too many things can happen where he advances his $600 a month for the term of the lease, but the defendant, who is a sublessee, can't respond in damages. So I submit to the court, economics takes care of a lot of the waste argument. What happened in that case was the Colorado Supreme Court said when the first lessee, that is the sublessor, negotiated a cancellation of the base lease, he, by accepting a termination, canceled the privity of a state relationship, that the right to remain in possession of the real property interest was canceled by the acquiescence of the sublessor, the landlord in the sublease arrangement. So you had a mutual act, the vacating of the premises by the subtenant, and the cancellation of the base lease by the sublessor. That destroyed the privity of the state concept and left the sublessee free from meeting his contractual obligation. What the Colorado Supreme Court said was, okay, that estate's gone, but the estate and contract is still there. Look to contract principles. Even though the base lease was canceled, Colorado Supreme Court said the sublessor can sue the sublessee for the rent that he would have earned under contract, get his damages under contract, but then recognize the duty of mitigation under the contract concepts. In our case, that is the Brown case, you don't have any act by the Republic Bank which acknowledges the cancellation of the privity of estate argument. Republic Bank, the trial court found, never acquiesced in the withdrawal from the premises by Mr. Brown. Mr. Phelps argues, well, he sent us a letter, he moved out, he took his property with him. But the finding of the trial court and the Court of Appeals, there's nothing that was done by the First National Bank or by Republic Bank later which could be argued to be an acceptance of the surrender of the premises. Texas has reached the Colorado point years ago. Texas reached it when Texas decided that if a landlord accepts the termination of the premises of the lease from by the tenant, if that is an accepted transaction, then Texas places on the landlord a duty to mitigate or to avoid the reasonable consequences, and that situation is the second right under Texas law that a landlord has. That is, first he can insist on the contract, stand on the conveyance of the interest in real property for the term, an act that was completed when the contract was signed, and collect his rent. Or, in the second alternative, he can accept the termination, re-enter in possession for the benefit of the tenant, release it, then collect from the original tenant the difference between the two contract lease amounts. The third option in Texas was he can take it, terminate by agreement the original lease, and he can lease it for more. And if he leases the second time for more than he had the first time, landlord gets to keep the difference because he has not, he has ended the contractual relationship with the tenant. And the fourth remedy that a Texas landlord had was the right to just take the premises and use them himself. So in the last three examples, or the last three portions of that rule, you have acts by the landlord which are sufficient to terminate the estate in land relationship. It's only in that first one, in the first option or right of a landlord, that is the right to take the premises and continue to make it available to the tenant for the term of the lease, that Texas has held on, and I believe properly, to the traditional concept that that is an interest in real property and that is an enforceable obligation. Let me cover quickly the Oregon case which was decided. That's Wright versus Ballman. Again, the Oregon court was not, in my opinion, faced with what we have today. The Oregon court did not have a tenant who had accepted a lease and was in possession of his tenancy, if you'll allow me to use that term. In the Bowman case out of Oregon, you had a contract to take a lease. You had a contract whereby the developer had said, I will build a space for your purposes and use. You agree that when I build the space, you will enter into a lease with me for a term at a stated price. But in that particular case, I believe the Oregon Supreme Court pointed out numerous times, the building was finished, but the tenant never moved in. The tenant decided he didn't want to occupy the space. He never accepted possession of the real property interest. So I submit the court never got to the question that you were being asked by Mr. Phelps to decide. The court concluded what they had was not a lease, but a contract to make a lease. The second important fact was the Supreme Court in Oregon looked to what the breaching party did. The breaching party did not, as Mr. Brown has done, just walk away and say, I'm not going to move in. When the tenant decided he was not going to occupy the space, he went out and found two other doctors who would occupy the same space that had been configured in the way it had been built without any changes, without any additional cost, without any additional expense to the landlord. And he presented these two doctors and said, here, I want you to enter into a lease with them either as substitute lessees or let me have a sub-tenancy arrangement. You take their occupancy. The landlord refused to do that. And the Supreme Court said we're not going to stand by and allow that kind of action, but Texas, I submit, would have reached the same conclusion. Because if you had the contract and if Mr. Brown had come to the court and never entered into possession of this premises and it said, here's my substitute, take him, and established as they did in Oregon that they were of equal strength and stature, you would have said, I believe, the bank or the landlord had the obligation, could not unreasonably refuse to take that substituted lessee.
Does the case show why the landlord in that situation refused to accept the two of the documents substitute?
I believe it does not. I think the court went off and pointed out that the doctors were of equal strength, and they found the refusal by the landlord was an unreasonable refusal. No explanation is in the record. The other thing, allow me to go on and talk about in this particular case. I believe that we have this privity of a state situation that this court must deal with if the court is going to take on the issue that Mr. Phelps presents. But let me assume that you're going to decide against me and you're going to change the law. You're going to say that we don't have any interest in land when we have leases anymore. I'm not going to repeat what's in the brief and what I believe would be the dire consequences of that. I think the economic waste argument will fall because that change in the law will be so dramatic that it will change the environment for business. A lot of these concepts were built not because they were agrarian, but because they promoted industry, they promoted business, they promoted the trade that had been developing over the centuries. Today, I submit, the economy in Texas needs decisions which enforce and establish the business environment. And changing this will disrupt it substantially.
How?
It leaves a confusion first with the tenant. If he enters into a lease and he has nothing but a contract, and his contract is only, he can only recover contractual damages, he's less likely to invest the capital to build a large plant, to improve his premises, to build his business. Because when he is ousted of possession and he's left strictly with contract remedies, he's only entitled to the difference between perhaps his investment and the rent difference, what he could do if he went out and found another space. Businesses want the security of knowing, I believe, that they can go into court and obtain specific performance, that they could obtain an injunction or injunctive relief from a district court allowing them to continue to occupy the space, enforce their contract, and not make them vacate. On the other hand, you've got the financing bodies. Mr. Felt argued that they really don't care. Well, I submit they do care. One of the questions today is how good is the tenant? How solid is his promise to pay? How solid is his commitment? And how solid is the right of the landlord to collect those rents if the landlord doesn't do anything wrong, that is, the landlord keeps his end of the bargain?
How would a duty to mitigate change that?
It raises in my mind, particularly if you accept the argument Mr. Felch is presenting, how the duty is to be placed and how the duty is to work. It puts a burden of proof and it puts a big question mark over what can a landlord actually get. Because if the court looks to the landlord, who's the non-breaching party, to prove some kind of a difference between what he would have gotten under the original lease and what he's going to get under the subsequent lease, the landlord may not be able to make that burden of proof. A trial court or a jury in their consideration of the case may place a very onerous burden on the plaintiff or on the landlord in that case, and there's just a question as to whether or not the landlord will ever get what the landlord originally contracted.
Object to leaving the determination of the duty to mitigate and whether or not it was met to the jury?
I don't think in the context that the court has written on the duty to mitigate, it has been left to the jury as a burden upon the landlord. I think it has been left as a burden upon the breaching party. I've cited to the court the Alford case, the Saltwater Flat case, which is a Supreme Court case out of 1936, which clearly said you look to the breaching party and what did the breaching party do, and I think those burdens should still be placed upon them.
A number of the of legal writers, and I'm not prepared to cite one, but just the things that I've read through the years, have indicated that jurisprudence in this country began in its early days as based on individual rights growing out of the revolution and so forth. And that toward the end of the last century and the beginning of this century, it shifted into more of a property rights jurisprudence, when the property rights were emphasized over individual rights. And that since World War II, that trend has begun to reverse itself. And there's been less emphasis on property rights being sacrosanct, and more a blend of equitable rights or personal rights. Does that conform to the brief history that you gave at the beginning of your argument about how these trends have developed?
I think it conforms.
Are those writers at odds with you? I'm trying to ask it.
I don't believe so. I think that the analysis in the Colorado Supreme Court goes back in a much larger time period. And if you look at simply the period of the Revolution to today, I think that argument can be made, and I think the argument is there. But I think if you look beyond that to an earlier period in the English common law from which we got most of our concepts, it becomes clear that initially we started out with pure contract rights, and that got modified perhaps too much to the concept that we will look strictly to the real property law to answer our questions. Then, since World War II, there's been kind of a balancing by the courts. That is, they look to the clause in the lease, or they look to the provision that's being disputed, and say, is that more of a contract-type provision, or is it more of the conveyance of an interest in land provision? And in the David Dow case, you looked at the provision, and I believe found that Dr. David Dow had a contractual right to receive the premises continually, and the landlord had assumed duties to maintain it, to heat it, to air condition it, to keep up the shopping area. Those rights were broken or violated by the action of the landlord, and he was given the implied suitability warranty to protect it. I don't have a problem with that, but in this particular case, you've got to focus on the conveyance for a period of years and the rent provision. That has always been viewed in real property terms. But again, let me say, assume with me you're going to not accept my argument. You're going to look at this in contract. In the contract that was the base lease, the landlord received the right to do exactly what he did. And by negotiation, Mr. Brown accepted the position. The First National Bank of Midland, or the Paragon Partners, have the contractual right to do what they did, and that was acknowledged by the tenant. And again, go back to the finding that Mr. Brown was in an equal bargaining position. Mr. Brown surely knew his obligation was to pay rent over that entire term. He was mistaken because he thought he could terminate it on 30 days' notice. Let me address that very briefly. Mr. Brown thought, as Mr. Felt has argued, you could take the 30-day provision out of the first agreement, put it into the second agreement. The trial court and the Court of Appeals, I believe, correctly said, no, you can't. The two agreements are not ambiguous. They are not in conflict. They stand on their own as separate instruments. One contained a right to terminate. That was for a limited term of 24 months. Mr. Brown stayed in the premises long beyond the 24 months. Therefore, he can't be under the original March agreement. He's occupying the space under the May agreement. Under the May agreement, he had the right to be there, but he didn't have the right to terminate. When you get to the fairness argument, you get to the equitable argument. In this particular case, the equity, I believe, is upon the landlord, because Republic Bank, if you let me use the argument, they're the landlord, really the sublessor, they did attempt to mitigate. Mr. Felt points to the record and says that the representatives of the bank said, no, they didn't attempt to lease Mr. Brown's space. That's absolutely true. They did not attempt to lease his space, but the record shows they did attempt to lease other space in the Paragon building. Under the base lease, they had 21,000 square feet. They ran advertisements in the Midland paper for a period of time in 1984. They received no takers. No one wanted the space. The trial court heard that testimony. The trial court also heard the testimony that the Midland Reporter-Telegram is a paper of general circulation, is the reasonable way in which you go about advertising, and the trial court heard from Mr. Phelps' own expert that he couldn't explain why there were no takers. In 1983, the First National Bank failed. In 1984, we were not in great shape. In 1985, the price of oil went down. These are alluded to in the record, as Mr. Phelps has said. The available tenants had dried up. The First National Bank had failed, therefore Republic had taken it over, and Republic had tried to find tenants in the Paragon building and could not do so. We believe that the burden should be upon the defendant, the breaching party in this case, Mr. Brown, to show that it was reasonable. If you're going to argue we have a duty to mitigate, then he should prove not only that we could have leased it, but what we could have leased it for. And I think that the best his record will support is a comment by one of the experts that said, I think you could get $10 a square foot. Mr. Phelps never asked for that finding by the trial court, never got that finding by the trial court. So in the record that's before the court today, I believe you should affirm the trial court's decision and affirm the action taken by the Court of Appeals.
The duty to mitigate can always be a part of the contract, can't it?
Yes, sir. And in fact, could be placed on either party. In this particular case, the contract does not place a duty to mitigate on the landlord, but gives the landlord, in fact, more power. It gives, in this particular lease, the power to sue for the remainder of the lease term as prepaid rent. And the concept being that if the tenant breached, then at that point the landlord can sue for the accelerated or the continued amount of rent, receive it as prepaid rent, then has the duty to hold that tenancy open during the term so that the tenant can come in and use it. Republic didn't go that far. They filed suit, but by the time we reached the trial level, all of the rent had actually been earned except for the month of December, and the trial court entered the finding that there was no reasonable expectation that the premises could have been reached, could have been leased for that particular month. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
With respect to responding to the argument by the respondent, I simply ask of this court to read the analysis that I argue to you in the Dushoff case, the Rice versus Bowman case, the Bernstein versus Siglin case, and the Colorado case of Schnitker v. Garden. And I submit to you that when those cases are read, and they're on pages 25 through 28 of my application, that they stand for the premise that I urge. They don't go off on specific fact situations. They say things such as, whatever historical justification existed for this rule, it is inappropriate in the commercial lease transactions today. One need only look at a modern lease, and the contractual aspect of the lease is evident. That's in the Arizona case. And citing McCormick in the Wright versus Bowman case, it states, McCormick predicted, this was in 1925, that eventually the logic inescapable according to the standards of a jurisprudence of conceptions which permits the landlord to stand idly by the vacant, abandoned premises and treat them as the property of the tenant and recover full rent will yield to the more realistic notions of social advantage which in other fields of law have forbidden a recovery for damages which the plaintiff by reasonable efforts could have avoided. Now if that is good enough for every field of the law except this one, I argue that's inappropriate. And that language is cited.
Mr. Kerr, can you respond to Justice Gray's question to the opposing counsel? You could have contracted the right to mitigate. Could you not put that in your contract, the main contract?
Sure.
And you did not?
Did not. Absolutely.
You could also contact the court with the right to terminate in the May agreement, have a clause right to termination. You did not consider to do that too.
Absolutely could have. Absolutely. No doubt in the world. That question is one which there is no answer that any lawyer could stand before this court other than say yes. But, let me say this, that's like saying that in any, forget this commercial lease, that's like saying that this court, in every contractual dispute you have before this court, that the law is going to be in the future that, Mister, if you didn't put it in your contract, there's no duty to mitigate. In every contract case before this court, and I submit to the court there's not any law that supports that, that you give up your duty to mitigate if you don't stick it in the contract. That's my position on that. Now,
how do you respond to Mr. Prothro's argument about the social utility of a known income stream for a fixed term and having landlords develop their property or invest substantial capital improvement?
Mr. Justice, I just don't understand. Because as I say, as I argued to you initially, Mr. Brown is still on that lease. He's still obligated. All I'm saying is they've got to go out and try to cut his damages. That's all I'm saying. He's still there. He's not forgiven of his obligation. How can that hurt anything? And there's another part to that. And I keep coming back to this, and I'm not doing a good job on this. Reasonable. That landlord has got to go out and make a reasonable effort. That doesn't mean that he can go out and take Joe Blow with a financial statement of minus $1 million, that he has to go do that and substitute him for Mr. Brown. He's just got to be reasonable. And then all of a sudden, there's some argument here, well, that's scary because you go ask a jury. Well, I mean, I've been making a living arguing to juries for 25 years. The jury system, there's nothing wrong with asking a jury if they made reasonable efforts to get somebody comparable to Mr. Brown.
Now, how about some of these leases, especially in your home area, that landlords have been making where the tenant gets a year or maybe even 2 years of rent free in exchange for a 5 or 10 year term? Would that, if we adopted this kind of provision, would that again be something the jury could consider?
Let's suppose
in order to attract a tenant, the landlord gives a 5 year lease with the first 2 years free.
Right.
Now, obviously, they're thinking of averaging that period out, and let's suppose after 2 years and 1 month, the tenant leaves and goes and finds another such deal. And, in fact, the landlord does manage to mitigate so that the tenant essentially gets 2 years free. Would that be something a jury could consider? I mean, it looks like a possibility for a windfall there if those kind of lease arrangements were to continue. The only way a landlord can make that kind of lease arrangement is to know the fixed term.
Right. I think I understand what you're saying. He's got to know the fixed term of the lease. And I think that when you put your expert testimony on to decide what the mitigation is versus what the real dollars were from the lease, you work all that out.
And so
I mean, that's just like, here again, this is what I keep coming back to. I mean, you can take shades and phases and come up with hypothetical facts on this kind of lease. But what I'm arguing to, you've got those kind of problems in all sorts of contracts. You've got all sorts of different types of considerations of the deal. But that doesn't blow the duty to go out and reasonably mitigate. I just stand here and I think, well, you're being repetitious. But why in the world don't you just apply the same old rules and go ask a jury what was reasonable? Just make him a duty to go out and try.
Counselor, I haven't heard either one of you argue contrary to the Court of Appeals holding that this termination agreement and the sublease was unambiguous. I assume both of you agree that it is unambiguous. Both of them are unambiguous.
Yes, sir. And let me try to hit that real quickly. I agree that it is clear, plain, and unambiguous, and I agree you've got before you a question of law. And I agree that what you do is you take the four corners of the two instruments and read them together. There is nothing in the second instrument that revokes the first instrument. Likewise, there's nothing that says that we take it forward. But the first instrument, there is no doubt that it was still alive after the sublease was entered into. When you read it, look and see if you don't see agreements by the bank that they still clearly, obviously, unambiguously had to perform. And you will see that that first instrument was still there. The sublease was still there. So you have to read them together. And I believe, I wouldn't swear to this, that it is part five of the termination agreement, whereby the bank agreed that Mr. Brown, and I think I'm quoting, would have the right to terminate the lease covering the space that he was going to use as interim space in the Paragon building at any time, quote, close quote, at any time, with upon, it says, 30 days written notice. And that, in that termination agreement, it is called interim space until he got another building, which he did. And I simply argue that when you read the lease, and the analysis is in my brief before this court, you will, the termination agreement contemplates that a lease will be entered into. It describes what the lease must have in it, at least 18 months free rent and 6 months at X number of dollars, and a right to terminate with 30 days notice. We did lease. We leased for longer than 24 months. We got 18 months free, and instead of 6 months at a certain cost, and it provided in Mr. Brown's agreement that it would be at whatever terms the bank was paying the owner of the Paragon, that we would pay the same cost. We got 5 years instead of 2 years. How does that wipe out the clear, plain, and unequivocal, when you read them together, right to terminate with 30 days notice? That's my argument.
How do you address the renegotiation argument Mr. Prothill made?
Well, the way I answer that is, once again, just go to the documents themselves and read the documents themselves and see if the documents, the intent of the parties, as evidenced by the documents, reflect in any way that the renegotiation gave up the 30-day notice. I say it's by the documents, it's not. And my analogy, where you take it, is in my brief. But there's nothing to reflect that we revoked that or we gave it up. Nothing in the documents. And you, all courts have accepted that both are still alive. And finally, last thing I want to say is that I argue that it's landlord and tenant law on mitigation. What difference could it make whether the bank was a sub-lessee? The bank still was the landlord, and all I'm saying is, a landlord, I don't care whether he's the lessee or the lessor, if you apply the language of the three cases I've cited, and I believe the precepts of David that way, that the landlord ought to reasonably, that runs tort law everywhere, reasonably try to mitigate damages.
Supposing we do make the change that you advocate, do you think it would violate public policy for us to do what we did in Davidow and say that the parties could contract out of this general obligation in the law? In other words, explicitly make a contract that says the landlord has no duty to mitigate?
Sure. I believe you can contract in or out anything you want to contract in or out. And if you're sitting there and you're negotiating the leases and you want to contract out mitigation, sure you can if you have an arm's length transaction. That's my position, though.
Do you think this might be different in residential than it is in commercial, which is a distinction we have on the implied warranty we found in Davidow? You cannot contract that out of a residential situation, but you can out of the commercial.
Well, I just don't see how you can do it on a commercial. I'm not prepared to argue on that.
If we're going to go on public policy grounds, then then why should you be permitted to contract out a mitigation of damages?
Well, Judge, I guess, I mean, you just hit me with that, and my reaction to it is that in a commercial setting, it seems to me, my gut reaction is that times have changed, and on a public policy basis and a realistic way we do business today, you ought to have a right to mitigate. At the same time, I believe two business people, if they wanted to say, I give up my social rights, if you'll lower my rent a little, I'd give it up, that they could strike a deal.
Has something to do with free people in a free country determine their own rights, doesn't it?
Well, you make a contract, I believe that. But at the same time, I don't think that there's anything about a contract of this type that would merit giving up what I think is the overwhelming, overriding jurisprudence of this state and this country, that somebody's got to go out and try to mitigate their own damages.
This is still a minority view, though, in landlord-tenant law. I gather it's an ever-increasing minority view.
I'll be honest with you, I think, but if you look at the section of Corpus Juris Secundum that I cited, they have a discussion, and it cites every case that the law is what I say it should be. And by the way, they put the Texas in the not sure category, because there are two cases cited in my brief that I could argue to you, you know, or for me, but there are more cases against me.
In this string site on page 28, you have two cases from the 1920s and one from 1930. Was this principle really adopted that long ago in those states, or was that situations like we have in Texas where mitigation is required in certain instances, like where the landlord steps in and changes the law?
Judge, I have looked at them, but it goes back much further than I thought it did when I got into it. I can't tell you the first one I can cite to you. My benchmark is this 1925 McCormick statement where he said, it's got to change.
And
he's
going.
All right, 35. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Tim.
It's been a great pleasure. As always, I appreciate it. Nice to see Judge Colvin and Judge.
The court will now take a brief recess.